Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 57, section 3, which is old single column, page 653. Okay, so remember, we just started part 3 of the book here. We just got going on the quote-unquote origin of Urantia, and boy, are they giving us origin. They're taking us all the way back to pre-ultimaton state, generating the ultimatons that are eventually going to be part of this planet. So that's a full-on origin story. And remember, we got in into that story a little ways to the point where the associate transcendental master force organizers had gone out to the whirl and the force charge that the primary force organizers had already had in place for some time. They didn't tell us how long that had been in place, but you had just that whirl and the force charge. And then the associate force organizers went out, and they began to condense that whirl in the force charge into ultimatons, starting, as you see there at the end of section 1, 875 billion years ago, they initiated that transformation from the whirl to ultimatons. And then we got into section 2, where you were moving forward a little bit with more and more of that whirl condensing into ultimatons, and then those ultimatons are going to be slowly collecting together into systems of 100 ultimatons. In other words, into electronic level particles, and then atoms. Okay, and at 700 billion years ago, they said that that actualization into ultimatons and those initial particles and atoms had reached a point where this gaseous nebula that that's evolving into existence, literally atoms, as a gaseous nebula, reached its maximum of diameter. You see right at that block for 700 billion, it says, it reached the maximum of diameter. It doesn't mean that everything is has been totally actualized yet, but initially, until you have objects that have mass, it's just going to be going around in the whirl. Nothing is going to be contracting, gravitationally. There's no gravity for it to be contracting yet. But eventually, when you start to have actual mass, the thing is going to start to contract. So there's going to be some point as it's coming into existence, it hasn't really started to contract yet at its biggest, but from that point on, it's going to start to contract. So it was at its maximum at 700 billion, and then you see it's at 600 billion. That's when it, right there in that first sentence of that block, it says that it reached its maximum of mass. So by 600 billion, you had everything, evolved up to the point where you have massive particles, atoms and whatnot. Okay? And so you don't have free ultimatons anymore and stuff. I mean, everything has gotten up to that point where technically, remember, it goes primordial force, emergent energy, and then universe power. You've gotten it all the way evolved to quote-unquote universe power, and it's got its maximum of mass there at 600 billion. And so that's the block that we still are technically in, is between 600 billion years ago and 500 billion years ago, as they start out section 3 here. And what we have is what they describe as a circular nebula. You've got this gas, but remember, it started out that whirl in the force charge is a flat, disc shape fact, right? So initially, all of the materialization is conformal to that disc, that circular disc. But as it starts to contract, you're going to start to build up a central bulge of gas. So it's all just, a smooth disc of gas, and it is rotating. And so as it starts to contract, it's going to start rotating faster and faster, especially those central regions. But it's basically flat with just central bulge. Okay? It's basically the same in every radial direction that you go out from the center. As you move out of the bulge, you're just into a disc, and the disc is same all the way around to start with. Okay? That's the quote-unquote circular nebula. Right? I mean, a circle is the same all the way around the diameter, right? So indicating the symmetry of it. Okay, then now we're going to move to the second stage, and things are going to start to complexify. But that central bulge of gas, is going to be referred to a lot as a mother nucleus, right? I mean, the gas is slowly accumulating in the center, stars are going to be born basically out of that central, accumulating collection of gas in that bulge. Okay. All right. So let's read in a little bit, and you'll see they just kind of step us through the process a little bit.
Number three, the secondary nebular stage. The enormous nebula now began gradually to assume the spiral form and to become clearly visible to the astronomers of even distant universes. This is the natural history of most nebulae. Before they begin to throw off suns and start upon the work of universe building. These secondary space nebulae are usually observed as spiral phenomena.
Okay, I mean, they're kind of giving you a quick little overview. They'll explain how that spiral comes about here in a second. Okay, but that's the basic shift that they're going to describe. They're going from circular to spiral, and remember again, nebula, literally just means cloud, basically, especially in this context. You have a cloud of gas. We don't have any stars yet. We just have a cloud of gas. And initially, when we start to get a spiral structure, it's still just all gas. Okay? So it definitely is a nebula. You really shouldn't be thinking of it as, what's invoked when you say galaxy, right? Some big system of stars. This is just a nebula still, very appropriately. It's just gas. Okay? And notice how they said it's going to start to become clearly visible to astronomers even in distant universes. Remember in the previous section, we could tell that we started with this, that whirl was completely outside of the Milky Way galaxy, off to the side in the super universe level. Remember they said at that time the easterly side, in the seventh super universe segment of the super universe level, and we could tell that as they were going through those hundreds of billions of years, the thing that had been moving in and was now down in the disk of the Milky Way galaxy, because they were talking about, remember, neighboring systems or universes having to deal with this, and we talked about all of that assimilation of it into the disk of the Milky Way. Especially relative to already established local universes that can't be disrupted and all those sorts of issues. Lots and lots of master physical controllers required to control all that process. Ones riding the galaxy in and the ones that are already in place in the Milky Way. But now you're starting to get something that where the gas is dense enough that you're going to be able to see it, you know, from a greater distance. Obviously, if it's the gas is very tenuous, you know, you get very, you know, too many thousands of light years away from it, and you're not going to be able to see it. Right? You know, it's going to get lost in the background. You're starting to get something that's going to, it's getting denser, and so you're going to be able to see it from a greater and greater distance. That's what they're referring to there. Now, and they'll explain this whole throwing off, you know, quote-unquote suns. Here is a, now, you know, kind of back up and give you the details of what they were just describing there. Let's see, I think, did I get everything there? You kind of see, as they go forward, I mean, you know, as soon as we started looking remotely with our telescopes, we discovered these amazingly beautiful objects, you know, in deep space, these spiral galaxies, and, you know, they've always fascinated us. And, you know, they're not italicizing there just, you know, to say, oh, you know what I'm talking about here, sort of. And you notice they didn't, they said spiral phenomena, right? There is a long-standing mystery ever since we first saw those things about what makes them spiral. How did they become to be these beautiful, you know, they look like they've been constructed or something in beautiful form, and lots of mysterious details, you know, as you look at all the different spirals, they're not all the same, and you can't figure out why they're not all, you know, what all the variations about, and as we're about to see here, they're going to give you a little clue that the basic spiral phenomenon isn't formed the way the current scientists have rationalized, right? So they're kind of highlighting that as note. You know, if you're a if you're an astronomer, if you'll be honest with yourself, you know you're really curious about what really forms that spiral thing, because you're not quite sure about the hand wavy rationalization scheme you got right now. All right, see, so it's sort of just a heads up why they're highlighting it like that. Okay.
John's got a question.
Oh, someone got a question.
He's wondering if the gas in these Earth at this early stage is primarily hydrogen.
You're starting, you know, literally from ultimatons, remember, and building up. So, smallest things first, right? I mean, you know, but you build up to larger and larger atoms as time goes by. You know, we've got hundreds of billions of years rolling by. I mean, you know, you've probably got some very large, you know, atoms that have built up, you know, and we haven't gotten any stars. We don't have any stars yet where we could be starting to, you know, tear things apart. Remember back when we talked about stellar energy generation, you know, back there in paper 41. You know, we haven't gotten to that point where anything could be in any significant way being torn back apart again after it's been built up, you know, even if it's a great big kind of delicate atom. So, yeah, there would be, but obviously, you know, you're building small up to big. So initially you've got a lot more hydrogen, you know, than anything else, and then helium. And I mean, that's why when you look out there, you see mostly hydrogen, and then next you see helium, and yeah, just because it's building from the bottom up. Smallest to largest. Okay, so.
The nearby star students of that faraway era, as they observed this metamorphosis of the Andromeda Nebula, saw exactly what 20th century astronomers see when they turn their telescopes spaceward and view the present age spiral nebulae of adjacent outer space.
The only difference is, remember, we're talking, you know, relative to the outer space levels, you know, first and second outer space levels, where you have, you know, galaxy formation going on right now. Though, you know, the run-of-the-mill galaxy out there is kind of Milky Way-sized. You know, here we're talking about something that's, you know, much, 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 much smaller than that, right? I mean, this little Andromeda nebula is, you know, minuscule compared to Milky Way or Andromeda or, you know, you know, the run-of-the-mill big spiral out there. But the physics is all, you know, basically the same, just bigger scale out there. Okay, so that's what they're, you know, indicating. See, and that's, like I said, see, you know, that just feeds into what I was just saying. You know, they italicize spiral phenomena, and then they, you know, they remind you of, you know, the fact you've been looking out there in the outer space levels, very fascinated by all these gorgeous spiral, this gorgeous spiral phenomenon out there, right? And the mysteries of how it comes to be so majestic and mysterious.
Yeah. I.e., it's planned. Personality managed.
Well, I mean, you know, you'll see it's, you know, there's a definite naturalness to it becoming spiral. But, you know, as we saw from the beginning, I mean, it all begins with beings, right? It begins with force organizers, and then it goes to power, the power beings. And but there's a lot of physics of the phenomenon that's not currently appreciated, that they're, you know... they're not giving you all the details of that physics, but they're saying, look for the answer in this way, not the way you are right now, as you'll see in a second here when we read. It's coming up here just right next. But anyway, yeah, so there it is. It's, you know, so spiral phenomena in italics is almost like a heading on that little paragraph we just read, see? Yeah. Okay.
About the time of the attainment of the maximum of mass, the gravity control of the gaseous content commenced to weaken, and there ensued the stage of gas escapement, the gas streaming forth as two gigantic and distinct arms, which took origin on opposite sides of the mother mass. The rapid revolutions of this enormous central core soon imparted a spiral appearance to these two projecting gas streams. The cooling and subsequent condensation of portions of these protruding arms eventually produced their knotted appearance. These denser portions were vast systems and subsystems of physical matter whirling through space in the midst of the gaseous cloud of the nebula, while being held securely within the gravity grasp of the mother will.
Okay, whole bunch there. Let's step through it. Okay, so you see why I did that little review, reminding you, you know, it's 600 billion years ago, you reached the maximum of mass, like they said. See, so picking up, see, where we left off last time, when you've got it to the point where it's at the maximum of mass, so you've, you know, you're definitively getting, you know, significant gravitational contraction of this gaseous nebula. It's the central bulge is getting bigger and denser. Okay, and there reaches some critical point where an amazing phenomenon occurs. It's not like, you know, it's contracting and spinning faster and faster, and then stuff just starts flying off in every direction, say, like you might guess, you know, like a rotating, you know, lawn sprinkler, right? No, there's this bipolar flow that ejects out of it. And this phenomenon of bipolar flows occurs all the way from... stellar scale things we observe with our telescopes to giant elliptical galaxies and, you know, in the outer space levels. You know, huge collections of multiple spirals. There's all kinds of different rationalization schemes for these bipolar flows. No one, you know, really knows what they're talking about. You know, especially, you know, they don't know what they're talking about if they have to bring in, you know, the magic of black holes to rationalize it. You know, imaginary objects. Okay.
You just said black holes were imaginary, but But you didn't mean dark islands of space.
I don't mean dark islands of space. Those are literal, and those are solid islands, okay. Not magical bottomless holes. Right? Infinitely deep magical holes. The way they rationalize the spiral phenomena, both of the Milky Way and in general, and all those spirals in the outer space levels, is they think you set up a spiral density wave. That you had a circular nebula, there's mathematically such a thing as a spiral density wave. You know, a density wave is like, as I'm talking to you, there's denser and rarefied, an oscillating wave going from my mouth across the room, right? You know, a density wave like that, so you have denser parts that, that are more visible and more rarefied parts in that spiral wave that are less visible, and they say that's why it appears that way. Well, that's all fine and dandy, maybe, until you, as long as you close your eyes to all the barred spiral galaxies. You got this thing where you've got a central bulge and these stick straight bars going way out to the very periphery and then two tiny little tails peeling off. That doesn't look like a spiral density wave to me, right? That's just the most glaring thing that flies in the face of rationalizing it as a spiral density wave when they aren't totally spiral. And they're telling you, no, it's not that. It's an actual ejection phenomena. Just like you know that some of those other things that you see that are these bipolar flows are ejection phenomena. It's obvious from looking at the morphology that you've got things being ejected in opposite directions from some central phenomenon. Okay?
There's some physics going on there.
Right, there's a physics that needs to be discovered about what generates this bipolar flow. Setting that aside, this is what happens. It's not a wave that just gets set up. You literally just are ejecting matter out, and the thing is spinning, of course, and so obviously, it wraps up into a spiral, because it just keeps, just like I said, like the lawn sprinkler. You look down on the pivot, rotating lawn sprinkler, and you see those streams of water, going out in spirals, right, from the sprinkler, just like that.
Doesn't that idea of that so, I don't know a good precise word, but this ejection,
bipolar ejection, right?
That to me just so says personality manage. It says something. Not just a simple gravity thing, but it just...
And what it says is, it seems to have so much pattern to it, so much seeming purposing to it. Remember, we're at the level where we have universe power, right? We're talking about mass, remember, and gravitating. Remember, again, they purposely called it universe power, not just, mass. Or something, right? They called it universe power because power means purposed energy, and that purposing is not just, the way you take an amorphous blob of clay and shape it, so that the purposing, so that it can be used to carry water, make a jar out of it and carry water. I mean that purposing isn't always something that's imposed from without upon it. I mean, the power beings are here doing stuff like that, but there's purposing that's inherent in the nature of physical phenomena that manifests under certain circumstances. But the seeds of that, remember, were back that the associate force organizers didn't have to stay all the way until, say, 600 billion years ago, making sure that last little automaton, is individuated out of the whirl. I mean, they just initiated it and left, and then it just You set a direction that's embedded within the nature of material phenomena. And that embedded purposing has a microscopic thing, manifestation in some cases, and a very macroscopic manifestation. You know, this large central bulge has inherent within it an ability to, you know, project out these two streams. I mean, it's in the physics of it, you know. I mean, if it was literally power beings in the center of thing with two garden hoses, you know, and a pump, they would tell you that because we could never figure that out. We would have to be told that. The fact they don't tell you the physics of it, you know, it's a natural part of a of the physics of that phenomenon, that material phenomenon. And you need to, you know, we need to work on figuring out how that comes to be. You know? So it's not so much the hand of, you know, a father-like hand of intervention. See, it's more the mother presence of the nature of what it is. It's inherent in what it is. Okay? And what's inherent in what it is has all kinds of cool things that are not immediately apparent. You look at the circular nebula, it's not immediately apparent that cloud of gas could do this wonderful thing of, yeah, but it's inherent there. You know, and it's going to have to do with the fact that matter is not just a finite phenomenon. Yeah, it's fundamentally absonite, you know, in nature. There is all of this this relationship of a fundamentally absonite phenomenon to the geometry of finite space. Right? To get into those details of how that fundamentally absonite phenomenon casts a shadow, if you will, manifests itself into a finite. Sometimes it's very, very symmetric, its manifestation in the finite. Other times not so. Right? It all depends upon the physics of that projection of the absonite into the finite. It's going to involve, you know, a better understanding of the deep nature of what it is. It's not just merely finite billiard balls that seem to be magically suddenly squirting out in two opposite directions. Right? You know, where's the geometry coming from?
Right? So it's not like a tidal phenomenon or something that we could observe, like a moon breaking up or those kinds of things.
Well, now you know. I mean, you know, see, you know, that, you know, like, you know, we'll read, you know, when we get deeper into this paper, you know, of that sort of quote-unquote bipolar tidal ejection, you know, that made our solar system on one side and some other stuff on the other side. You know, here, I mean, you obviously, it isn't because some object went by and pulled it. I mean, you know that just by looking at a spiral. A spiral isn't, the galaxy isn't lopsided. It's not like there's more, you know, coming out, you know, on one side of the galaxy and the other. Right? It's very symmetric. So it isn't the imposition of a line upon a circle. You know, the moon imposes a line upon the circle of the Earth and makes a tidal bulge on both sides of the Earth. You know, so where did this, what broke the symmetry of the circle? It wasn't an external influence, something inherent. What is that?
There's nothing on a smaller scale where we see that anywhere, right?
Well, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of, I mean,
it's a big, huge sphere.
I mean, you know that things, you know, when something rotates, it has two poles. But, you know, to think in more general terms about, you know, remember the absonite motions themselves are rotations. So microscopically, you have, it isn't spherically symmetric. You know, is it something to do with that? You can speculate. Somehow you have a macroscopic coherent expression. you know, of a bipolar, just like, you know, a single, you know, rotating object is coherently, you know, coherent. You know, you don't have the parts of that rotating object going in every which direction. They're all working together in this wonderful symmetry of a rotating object. Again, to remember, it's a universe of motion, not a universe of, you know, static matter billiard balls that are set in motion. You know, you're seeing a motion, a new motion manifesting here. You know, you haven't set billiard balls in motion like it appears fundamentally. It's an additional motion manifesting that wasn't manifesting before. It's not the motion of things, it's motion most fundamentally. All those thoughts help you see where the investigation has to go to try to find the answer to these mysteries. Okay, anyway, don't want to get too far off in physics here. Okay, so you've got that, that biggie. You know, and it's not like way back when we first discovered spiral galaxies, someone didn't think, well, I think it must be something ejecting, but no one could dream up any reason why there would be stuff ejecting from two sides, and so they threw that idea out. You know, and if you know that history, you'd say, oh, well, Hoover wrote this book, you know, he wrote it back, you know, before we knew better. It's like, no, you know that's not the case. You know, the very fact that we couldn't convince ourselves that that was what it was, even though that seemed to be the immediate obvious answer, is why they can tell you it here. We can't figure it out ourselves that it actually is two streams. We've convinced ourselves it isn't. Right? So that's why they can tell you it here. If we had definitively figured that out, had no question about it right now, it wouldn't be in here. Right? I mean, again, they can only tell you what we can't figure out ourselves. So, of course, if it's something we think we understand, it's not going to agree with our rationalization, what's in the Arrangement Book. If it agreed, it would be a violation of the revelatory mandate. They can't tell us stuff that we can figure out ourselves. Okay. So, all right. So that really, that's a big help to throw out all other rationalization schemes and just focus. Okay, somehow there's this bipolar flow. Try to and work on that basic picture. Figure out the details. Okay, so that's what we got. And when they say rapid revolutions of this enormous central core, you know. Rapid relative to the disk of gas that's, you know, still outside of that central bulge. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, spinning at a trillion RPM, right, or anything. It's, you know, rapid in a relative sense to the big, lumbering, slow outer regions of the disk. Notice how they point out that knotted appearance. You eject this gas out. And, you know, it's mass, it's a gas, it's going to gravitate, it's going to start to collect into knots, right, of gas. And the denser it gets, the easier it is to see. You know, if you look at those galaxies in the outer space levels, you know, you've got these knots, you know, that are really easy to see. You don't have to take a long exposure to see the knots, but the longer the exposure you take, the more you can see the stuff between the knots of glowing arms. Yeah. So just what you expect, the denser it is, the more easily it is to see from a greater and greater distance. Because it's, you know, the stuff is hot, so it's giving off photons. Right? It's heated gas. If it was cold, you know, it wouldn't be giving off any light. You couldn't see it no matter how dense it was, right? But it's, you know, it's glowing, it's radiating. Okay, so there's that. And then continue on there, these denser portions were vast systems and subsystems of physical matter whirling through space in the midst of the gaseous cloud of the nebula. So see, there's kind of evolving their language a little bit. You have, didn't they just use that, like the mother mass there? And, you've got an awful lot of the gas all in that central bulge region, but there's still, a continuous cloud of gas that's still out in the disk. So when you eject these arms out, they're not ejecting out into empty space. they're ejecting out in the midst of that circular disk of gas that's still there, as they're telling, in the midst of the gaseous cloud. So you've got the central nucleus on the one hand, and then you have the quote-unquote gaseous cloud, the stuff that's still in the disk and hasn't gravitationally contracted into the center yet. Okay, at 600 billion years ago, right, there's still a lot of it in the disk. That gas is still in the disk. I want to make sure you don't get confused by some of these statements here. And notice what they said there. You're ejecting out this matter to form these arms, but it's not like you're ejecting it so fast that it goes flying off into deep space. Right? It's still very much in the gravity grasp of that central collection, that central nuclear mass of matter in the bulge in the center. Okay, so you're taking the circular nebula and you're just giving it a lot more structure, but everything is still kind of just, you know, going around like it was before. All right, now what happens though?
But the nebula had begun to contract, and the increase in the rate of revolution further lessened gravity control. And ere long, the outer gaseous regions began actually to escape from the immediate embrace of the nebular nucleus, passing out into space on circuits of irregular outline, returning to the nuclear regions to complete their circuits, and so on. But this was only a temporary stage of nebular progression. The ever-increasing rate of whirling was soon to throw enormous suns off into space on independent circuits.
Okay, so you have this, you know, fairly tenuous gas in the disk, like I was just talking about that, you know, as they called it, the gaseous cloud. But, and you've got this much more dense central region, the nebular nucleus, you know, or, you know, whatever term they use in a particular sentence there. And see, what they're saying is it's contracting and it's spinning faster and faster, to the point where stuff is going to start to fly off, but not, you know, way off. But, you know, like, think about pictures you've seen of the sun. You know, now we can take really nice close-up pictures of the sun. You know, you got gas, you know, being spewed out and then falling back into the sun all the time, right? It's not going flying off past the planets or anything. It, you know, it's pretty localized, but it's being spewed out and then falling back in. So that's what they're saying is happening, you know, in a much more all the way around fashion, because it's just spinning faster and faster, and some stuff is flying off, but it just comes back around and falls back in. Okay, so there's this initial stage where it's a little bit chaotic in the center.
They're mixing it.
Right, it's definitely getting mixed, and yep. So all that's going on, you know, while further out, you know, you have these arms that have wrapped into a spiral, you know, and then the thin circular cloud of more tenuous gas that's in the whole disk. So that's the picture. See, it's getting more complicated. And notice what they say. You know, this bit of stuff, just kind of haphazardly, you know, flying off and falling back in. That's just a very temporary stage. It's eventually going to, you know, it keeps contracting, and it's going to start to get much more definitively localized. And it's not going to be kind of ragged edges, you know. It's going to get much more definitively localized. And then it's going to start sending definitively more gas out in that spiral pattern. As we go forward, everything is going to be just keep from the central nucleus. It's just going to keep pumping more and more gas out into those arms, right? And as long as there aren't external disturbances, you know, it's going to stay very clean and symmetric. But you know, remember in that very first paragraph in this section, how they threw in qualifiers. This is the natural history of most nebula, and these secondary space nebulae are usually observed as spiral phenomena. Obviously, there can be all kinds of complications, especially since, like, the Andromeda Nebula here is down in the midst of all the other stuff that's going to be part of Nebadon. You know, there's going to be, you know, interactions. Things are going to be tugging and pulling and disturbing a bit. It's not going to stay nice and perfectly clean. But, you know, setting all those minor details aside, you know, you basically have this phenomenon of just more and more ejecting what gravitationally collected in the center out through these arms. Okay. All right. Let's see here. What else do we have there? Go ahead.
What would happen if it weren't for this phenomena of the arms? Would it just keep getting denser and denser?
If there was nothing that would, sort of send it out there, you know, you'd have just an incredible collection of gas, you know, very, very large compared to a star, right? Very large collection of gas, you know, just collecting into one big spherical blob in the center, you know, and becoming an extremely unstable, you know, phenomenon. I mean, eventually, you know, you could imagine some sort of unbelievable supernova-like cataclysm, you know, of this thing or whatnot. Notice that coincidentally, there's all this stuff, so that even when you're dealing with such enormous energies as this, enormous energy potentials, that could be quite disruptive, there's this relatively controlled way that all that energy ends up in stars the way you want it to. Majestic little stable stars going through space. Instead of, you know, kerblooey, well, we blew up that whole portion of the Milky Way galaxy.
That was fun.
Yeah, it's too bad that local universe had been settled in light and life for trillions of years, and now it's not. See, just think about that, like I said, that purposing. You know, how everything, you know, works so that what we're talking about can be, that you can have something as energetic as this giant collection of gas being brought right down into the midst of settled areas in the Milky Way and everything. The master physical controllers can get a collection of matter grouped together as a local universe, even while it's all evolving like this, you know, and it's not going to do something cataclysmic on them and, you know, make that impossible. And yet it's doing extremely, you know, energetic things, you know, in a way. Making stars, right? You know, that's no minor phenomenon.
Okay. Suppose they have a containment method if they ever needed it.
So,
this one's going to really get crazy here pretty soon.
Well, you'll actually see there's shades of that coming up here in a little bit. Okay, let's see here. We got everything here? Yeah, so just that last sentence. So the ever-increasing rate of whirling, you know, it's, you know, again, just remember, inexorably, you've got mass here, and it's gravitationally, you know, contracting. Right? So the central thing, no matter how much, you know, falderal might be going on, is getting hotter and hotter and denser and denser, and things have got to happen. You know, you've got a pressure cooker building there, right? Okay.
And this is what happened in Andromeda ages upon ages ago. The energy wheel grew and grew until it attained its maximum of expansion, and then, when contraction set in, it whirled on faster and faster until eventually the critical centrifugal stage was reached and the great breakup began.
Okay, so that last little paragraph, see, sums up, you know, everything, harkening back to the previous section, you know, and just giving you a little overview again. You know, remember that maximum expansion that was back there at 700 billion years ago? So it's just giving you a little synopsis. You know, you've got this critical centrifugal stage, you know, that's obviously going to, you know, it's spinning faster and faster and faster, and, you know, something's going to happen here. But just the fascinating way that it happens in such a regular, controlled fashion, what's building there, that energy is released in such a delightfully controlled fashion, considering the enormity of the phenomenon. Right, remember, we're talking about enough gas to make a million stars, over a million stars. This is a lot of gas. Yeah. Okay? A lot of energy. Okay, so now we'll move to the next notch of time here.
500 billion years ago, the first Andronovore sun was born. This blazing streak broke away from the mother gravity grasp and tore out into space on an independent adventure in the cosmos of creation. Its orbit was determined by its path of escape. Such young suns quickly become spherical and start out on their long and eventful careers as the stars of space. Accepting terminal nebular nucleuses, the vast majority of Vovontan suns have had an analogous birth. These escaping suns pass through varied periods of evolution and subsequent universe service.
So in other words, that last sentence, you know, they're not going to go into all that stellar evolution stuff, and a lot of it, you know, that we can figure out eventually ourselves. But, you know, you got to be delighted by the poetic and kind of anthropomorphic way they're describing the birth of these stars. We saw that before. Remember way back, you know, we were doing paper 41, how at times it almost seemed like they were talking about these physical phenomena in ways very similar to talking about beings.
Calcium.
Things and beings, right? You know, when you're in the central universe, things and beings aren't so different, right? The glory of the pattern, the energy pattern of things is just as glorious as the personal pattern of beings, right? And so occasionally, you know, see, they're doing it here again to get you to think, you know, don't think of this as just, you know, dirt ball, you know, construction here. It's all part of one system. You know, the suns are just as significant a part of the whole system under the umbrella of the Supreme as one of us.
As the suns.
As the S-O-N-S, yes. At the S-U-N-S and the S-O-N-S, yeah. We brought that up before when we got into this, right? See, and they're just trying to remind you of that by using that kind of poetic, you know, language, where it almost sounds like they're, you know, it's finally your kid has grown up and it's time to send them out into the world, you know. See, they're giving you that kind of language. Okay, but remember specifically, you know, in the midst of all that poetry, you've got matter that's, you know, that's being ejected out from the center in these, you know, spiral arms. And eventually you're going to have those knots, you know, and within one of those knots, you know, you're actually going to get something that condenses to the point where, you know, you're literally getting a star-sized collection getting into a star-sized space, and it finally getting hot enough in the center of that region of gas to begin to unravel the collections of 100 ultimatons. Remember, that's what defines a star. You know, when they, or a sun here, the first sun was born. What, that doesn't mean you just have kind of a localized hot ball of gas. It means it's gotten to the point where all this stuff that you slowly built up, you know, is now down in the center of one of these ever hotter, you know, regions of gas, to the point where it starts to boil, right? The electronic boiling point, as they call it. Right? It gets so hot that it starts to unravel those collections of 100 ultimatons, right? And all the atoms and particles that those atoms are made out of begin to unravel, and, you know, and you're releasing that energy that is the primary energy generating mechanism of a star. You know, more fundamental than fusion or fission.
Solar output.
Right? Unraveling the collections of 100 ultimatons in those hot centers. That's what makes a star. Distinguishes a star from just a blob of gas. Right?
And only the heat does that.
Right? And it's just, yeah, it gets, you know, it's very, very, you know, the gravity is holding it very tight, you know, so you can get hotter and hotter and hotter till you get to that point where it's so hot it begins to unravel those collections of 100 ultimatons. In other words, you get such extreme motion that when of an opposite kind, that when you add it to the motion that is that assemblage of 100 ultimatons, right, the two motions are canceling out and the motions unravel. Right? Because, you know, again, don't think of the ultimatons as little billiard balls that are glued together into a collection of 100 billiard balls. An ultimaton is a unit of motion, and the collection of 100 is a system of motion. It's all motion, no matter how incomprehensible that is. And so it's what you're always doing is you're adding and subtracting motions of various types. And, you know, sometimes you add two motions together, they are, you know, they cancel each other. Yep.
Well, these suns live a long time and yep. put out a tremendous amount of energy.
Right.
Almost unbelievable amounts of energy.
Yes.
Well, that energy had to come from somewhere to get concentrated in a sun. So where's that differential get concentrated?
You have all... See, that uncontracted cloud of gas has a vast amount of potential energy. I mean, just thinking about it in terms that we can simply understand, just think about it gravitationally. How much gravitational potential energy there is there that you can actualize if you collapse it together. That's what you've done. You've taken, you know, you have this vast system that in all kinds of different ways has the potential to be these little nuclei, if you will, of energy generation, a star. Right? And you just localize all that potential and you actualize that potential out into the greater universe. And, you know, just remember that there's a lot more potential energy there than just that simple gravitational, yeah, concept of gravitational potential energy. Fundamentally, where all of this, you know, energy is motion. Where did all this motion come from? Right, that initial whirl, right? I mean, who put this potential into place there? Those primary, eventuated, you know, master force organizers. They had it all. It's all inherent in that whirl, and then you're just doing stuff with that type of motion, that type of energy. You're converting into other types of energies, eventually into energy that we can understand. As opposed to sub-electronic energy. But it's all motion. You know, you could say electronic level motion and sub-electronic level motion. It all starts as the motion that is that whirl. And then you're doing all sorts of creative things with that raw material, that raw motion, bottling it up into little ultimatons and whatnot.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to run down.
Right, and it doesn't run down, right? Because, again, it's not like it's the motion of something, and so, well, there's got to be some friction, you know? Right. No, it is just it's just motion.
It's just beyond me, because this is pre-gravity motion.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, an example of where you see that frictionless, you know, the fact that things is fundamentally a universe of motion and not a matter, is when you have puzzling manifestations of what we think of as fundamentally friction-like motion not having any friction. A current with no resistance. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago we discovered superconductors. You know, where you have a current with no resistance. You know, we think billiard balls moving with no friction. Sounds kind of magical. Right, see, I mean, that's little things like that, you know, if you would look at them objectively, you know, instead of trying to impose the billiard ball model on everything, it's like, no, it's fundamentally a universe of motion. Don't be surprised if you can have motion without any friction because, I mean, it just is motion.
Yeah. You know, run down.
Gravity is a motion. Does gravity run down? Do you have to change the batteries on a mass to keep it gravitating? A magnet, you know, that phenomenon, magnetic phenomenon, that's a motion. Do you have to change the batteries on your refrigerator magnets? No. It's a quote-unquote frictionless motion. Quite, you know, it's just motion.
But you could probably sell it.
Tell them, you know, yes, do you know that eventually those refrigerator magnets are going to need their batteries changed? You know, and all, I'd like to sell you that and the Brooklyn Bridge. Right. Okay, anyway, back to the story here. But it's just, like as I was trying to, you know, suggest when we were talking about the spiral, you know, the bipolar ejection, just remember everything is fundamentally a motion. And so the universe is inherently dynamic. When we see dynamic phenomena, we have to try to solve the mystery of where did the dynamism come from? You know, we think everything is inherently static. And then it's kind of a mystery when there's motion. Yeah. Like, no, everything is fundamentally in motion. It's more of a mystery if there's something that's static.
Right.
Not the other way around. Right?
That's why I have a hard time sleeping
here. It's not a mystery that things move at the speed of light. It's a mystery that things appear to not move at the speed of light. Yeah. It's the other way around from what we think. Okay, let's see, what else?
To ask about,
okay.
Before you go on, in that this last paragraph where so much of it sounded alive and living.
Mm-hmm, right, right.
And they're using these terms, you know, like the mother...
Right.
Gravity and...
And you've got the mother nucleus, and you've got these children, these sons that are being sent out into the world. Yes, right. Being born out of the womb of that mother nucleus, yes.
Well, right. You know, when I'm thinking about the super universe being a womb, at least for the mother, the mind womb of the mother of that level, that domain, these kind of things where you have the bipolar ejection and then all of this beautiful movement there, it makes me think, I've ever since we started this paper, I've been trying to find something that has some pattern to it that I can... think about
in relation
to this.
An analogy that you can, yeah.
Yeah, right, right. And I don't know, but maybe a heart, the physical heart, or the, I don't know how enough about, I know nothing hardly, about the mind and how it works, but I think of the heart and how things come in and out of it and it pumps and it moves and it's got motion and... anyway, yeah. I think of the big picture of the mind womb of the mother, and then how this is a real, all of it is a system that's working together somehow.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said, you know, early on, you know, don't think of this as some, you know, like this bipolar ejection. Don't think of it as some sort of a father-like intervention into what was there. Yeah. In general, think of everything as being fundamentally within the wholeness of the mother. There is all this diversity of parts and their behavior. Right? It's all contained within the wholeness that Mother Deity encompasses. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about mind, you know, or matter, or what, you'll notice that it all has this kind of parallel analogy, like you're struggling with, to think about, you know, parallel analogies. Because matter, mind, and spirit are a triunity within the encompassment of Mother Deity. And it's all one phenomenon. And so, you know, it's very purposeful that they keep using these mother, metaphors here. Right, to just remind you that this is not a father interventionary thing, like the way you're used to rationalizing everything. You need to think more inherent, innate within everything. There's those who designed this these material phenomena see the end from the beginning. Right. They don't just see the beginning and then down the road a ways, we need to add this additional thing, to make it do this now. No, everything that automatons will need to do when we get to future eternity is built into them, from the start. Just to appreciate that wholeness, that innateness of how purpose is embedded in this infinite, eternal purpose is embedded in the most mundane, minute element of parts. Okay, think about it in those holistic, organismal terms. See, that's why you're going to heart, because you're thinking about this is like an organism, right? And an organism is an organism because there's wholeness. There's not just parts. Father can't make organisms. Organisms are an expression of the wholeness of the mother. Right? You're just appreciating that. It's like no one seemed to like squirt that in anywhere. It just seems like somehow to just be there. Yeah. Remember when the Revelators, allude to those sorts of things. It's like, well, we don't really understand how this comes to pass. It's something to do with the inscrutable supreme or the inscrutable. That's referring to the wholeness is just there. Right? The closest that humans have gotten to the recognition of that sort of intangible wholeness that does very amazing things at times is providence. Right? Right? There's a wholeness. There's a providence. There's a presence of wholeness. The parts are within a wholeness, and parts sometimes do things that no part can do unto itself. And it's not because parts are magical; it's because parts are part of a whole. Right? And so it's just all the different ways that you can appreciate that in the majesty that is a little spiral nebula, even. Okay. All right. Let's see. So. Just one little thing before we're gone, because they'll pick this up. Remember, they said, okay, so most of the time you've got stars that are just being born like this, being ejected out of this central bulge region, okay? You've got gas just being ejected out, and it's condensing into a star, right? One of the exceptions is, eventually, you'll have basically everything ejected out, and you'll have the residual gas in the center that'll collect into a star sometimes. Okay, like it did in our case of the Andromeda Nebula. Remember, we'll come back to that. That accepting terminal nuclear nucleuses. Right? Okay, what happens at 400 billion years ago?
400 billion years ago began the recaptive period of the Andromeda Nebula. Many of the nearby and smaller suns were recaptured as a result of the gradual enlargement and further condensation of the mother nucleus. Very soon, there was inaugurated the terminal phase of nebular condensation, the period which always precedes the final segregation of these immense space aggregations of energy and matter.
Okay, so you've got some stars, you know, that have formed not too far away from the nuclear mass. But remember, we have all this gas that's still out in the disk, and it's slowly coming in. So that nebular mass is going to grow. Yeah, and it's going to swallow up some of those stars that were, you know, close in. That's what they're referring to. See, recaptured. You know, so they're just going to get ingested back in and torn apart, you know, and, you know, disassembled as a separate collection. You know, the unraveling of the collections of 100 ultimatons will be turned off because it'll cool off when you, you know, shred it apart, shred the star apart in this massive energetic thing in the center here. You know, it'll chew up star like nothing, right? Because it's gigantic, this central region. Very energetic. These immense space aggregations of energy and matter, as they're saying. All right, so, you know, 400 billion years ago, things are still, you know, in a very early stage, see? I mean, you're like, oh, we've got this star. Oh, no, no, we don't. It just got swallowed back up again. You know, it's like, oh, look at that beautiful comet. Oh, it just fell into the sun. right? I mean, sometimes, you know, we watch a comet go in, you know, around the sun, and it never comes back around the other side because it falls in. So you've got that sort of thing happening only on a massive scale where stars are getting... but it's mainly because, like they're saying, you have so much gas out in the disk yet that hasn't gotten in, and so it's going to be just growing and swallowing them up as it grows. But obviously it's going to continue to condense. And it just means you've got, the more it condenses, you have more and more mass there that's condensing. So you're setting yourself up for even bigger, you know, potentials to spew out stars. As this pressure cooker just gets fed and fed and fed. Okay. All right. Now we got a little aside.
It was scarcely a million years subsequent to this epoch that Michael of Nodon, a creator son of paradise, selected this disintegrating nebula as the site of his adventure in universe building. Almost immediately, the architectural worlds of Salvington and the 100 constellation headquarters groups of planets were begun. It required almost 1 million years to complete these clusters of specially created worlds. The local system headquarters planets were constructed over a period extending from that time to about 5 billion years ago.
Okay, see, so the first thing, it was scarcely a million years subsequent to this epoch. You know, the epoch, you know, that they're speaking of is the 400 billion years ago. Right, so which ends at quote unquote 300 billion years ago. So at roughly 300 billion years ago is when they started constructing the architectural spheres. And when it says Michael you know, selected this disintegrating nebula, you know, not just this one was part of what he selected. All of the other stuff that, you know, goes into make up Nebadon. You know, like we've stressed so many times. Remember, they remind you of that at the beginning of this paper. Don't forget, Andromeda was just part of Nebadon. It's not all of Nebadon. You know, so when we focus down in on Andromeda and say things like this, don't get confused. Right? He's selecting it, yes, but with everything else that he's selecting. Not just selecting it.
This must have been a key point or key part.
Let's think about this. So, yeah, it's just a point I was just going to make. So we've got the Andromeda Nebula part of Nebadon, and an obviously still pretty early dynamic state here at 400 billion years ago. I mean, you got stars being, you know, birthed and then getting, you know, reabsorbed. I mean, this is still a pretty tentative situation here, stability wise. It's 300 billion years ago that we're technically talking about that they start building. But think about this. They can't build Salvington and its worlds and the Constellation headquarters in their worlds in a place like that's going to get absorbed into the mother nucleus of something, for instance, right? Yeah. So, you've got 101, big collections that you got to build, and they're going to be in safe areas. Because it's not just the Andromeda Nebula, all the other stuff is probably in very early stages too. Who knows where? Some of it might even be more primitive than Andromeda. Who knows what the rest of Nebulon's like? So initially, it's apparent they can initially easily find the 101 locations where they don't have to worry about, something cataclysmic happening there. But the local systems headquarters, all of those, initially there isn't locations to build those. I mean, where it's not going to get destroyed. Right? So the building of those, see, goes on until things have totally settled down in Nebulon, basically, and just 5 billion years ago, they were building the last ones because finally where they needed to build that was finished enough that it wasn't going to get destroyed after they built it. Yeah. Now, obviously, power beings could protect some, but power beings aren't going to be like stopping stars getting absorbed into those nuclear bulges again and stuff like that. Okay, so they build wisely, and they build initially where they can, and when they can spread out over billions and billions of years, when it's finally possible. Right, so that's what's going on there. Things must be kind of in a similar state to the Andromeda in terms of the evolution and the rest of Nebulon. If they're going forward with all 100 constellation headquarters, those are going to be all over Nebulon.
And he selected this disintegrating one as a site of his adventure. So it must have been something central about that, or something.
I've been so stressing, because you can overplay that if you. Salvington is nowhere near the Andromeda Nebula. Like you say, well, it must be important, so Salvington must be at the center of the Andromeda Nebula. No, you know what the center of the Andromeda Nebula looks like right here. It's no place to build Salvington. Salvington would be ripped to shreds if you build it in the center of the Andromeda Nebula here right now, right? It's just remember they're just focusing on this one nebula because it's where our sun comes from, right?
So
he's selecting it and others.
You just go back to him for selecting it for a second.
Yeah.
So there's only so many Michaels left that haven't selected because we're pretty
young, right? Right.
So do you think the Michaels are still yet to have selected, are sitting around, hey, this one's mine, this one's yours. Oh, there's four or five of us bidding on this one. You know what I'm saying? When they said they selected.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to ponder that in a way.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's just, we talked about that some way back when we talked about the Michaels doing that. But think again about what I was just saying in response to that poetic language that we just read in the previous paragraph. They're not just saying, dirt balls are dirt balls. Let's take this collection of dirt balls. No, they are a unique part of the wholeness of the Supreme, that Creator, Son, and Creator, Mother, Spirit. And the beings that are going to come from them can only go in association with a certain collection of matter. There's a certain collection of matter that was designed and is evolving towards being the only place where our Creator, Son, and Creator, Mother, Spirit can have their beings.
The only begotten.
You can't have the beings on a given Havona world can't be on any other Havona world. Fundamentally, because they're fundamentally together as a power personality synthesis, basically with the matter of that world. Right? It's the same thing out here. They're waiting. They have the master architects are in charge of all this, and so those Michael sons are sitting there in paradise, It's like, well, eventually I suppose the master architects will get around to making my local universe. I'm looking, that's not there yet. I mean, they know what the pattern is that matches them and doesn't match any other creator son.
Then why do they say he selected it? I mean, that seems to me to be...
Because everything is a free will choice. I mean, is Michael divine... That's why, right? I mean, everything... It's mind-made and personality-managed. Everything is chosen. Right? It's not...
quote-unquote ordained, but still it's a free will choice.
I mean, everything, no matter... Remember how they tell you, no matter how automatic something might seem, if you back up far enough, it isn't. Right? The universe in its entirety is personality managed. I mean, everything is chosen. So just, you know, just to keep that in mind. Yeah.
It's like when you choose a woman to marry, you know, hopefully this isn't providential, but not always.
bring in kind of that dynamic. That Michael has free will. He could unwisely choose another one. I mean, and he wouldn't be stopped.
He probably wouldn't.
But he won't. Yeah, right. Just again, like he could choose to be iniquitous, but he won't. Yeah, right. he will always make the wise choice. You know, I mean, again, that's, you know, remember, that's what you're getting to when you get to Avona. You still have absolute free will. You could choose any old damn thing you please. But you're going to choose only one thing. There's only one right way to do each thing, and you will wisely choose that one right way with your free will. Right? That's the universe we live in.
I have such a good time choosing the wrong way. Get out of your system.
Right?
So true.
It's just so important, you know, to not... You know, you have free will.
That's what experience wisdom about, right?
But remember, there's two consecrations. You're not just consecrating your will, you're also consecrating your mind. You need the wisdom to go with the will. Right? The wisdom, the insight, the foresight to always choose rightly. Choosing rightly isn't inherent in your will. Otherwise, there would be no iniquity, no sin.
No evolution.
Right? No, it takes two things, right? It takes the ability to choose, and then it takes the wisdom to choose rightly. And they're not the same thing. They're two separate things.
They talk about that when they talk about your thought adjuster working with you.
Right.
Choosing between right and wrong.
There is a right way, but it's not forced on you. You have to eventually mature in your relationship to God the Mother to see yourself that is indeed the right way and choose it of your own free will. Okay, so now with this paragraph about building these, I wanted to just drop back. We've kind of touched on this some before. I suppose if I am going to read a whole paragraph, if you wanted to follow. So this is paper 15. Section 3, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, which is the sixth paragraph of the section. It's the second paragraph at the top of page 168 in the single column. You know, so back there in that paper on the seven superuniverses, I wanted to just remind you of a little bit more of the story that they mentioned back there, what we're reading here. They say the following: the nucleus of the physical system to which your sun and its associated planets belong is the center of the one-time Andromeda Nebula. This former spiral nebula was slightly distorted by the gravity disruptions associated with the events which were attendant upon the birth of your solar system and which were occasioned by the near approach of a large neighboring nebula. This near collision changed Andromeda into a somewhat globular aggregation, but did not wholly destroy the two-way precession of the suns and their associated physical groups. Your solar system now occupies a fairly central portion of one of the arms of this distorted spiral, situated about halfway from the center out towards the edge of the star stream. Okay, so you can see a lot of what they're saying there is what we're just reading again about those star streams. And sure enough, you know, ours came out, you know, one of those spiral arms. But remembering how it's not the only thing of Nebadon. And, you know, we know that that dark island is going to go past our star, you know, eventually and draw out our solar system. You know, and that thing is, you know, plowing through this whole region of space. It's obviously going to mess up the beautiful spiral of Andromeda some as it plows through this region, right? So that's what they're mentioning there. And also, see, another part of Nebadon is, right, that's immediately next to us was apparently one of these very large, neighboring, probably bigger than Andromeda, this large neighboring nebula. You know, and so you've got this one that's part of this construction of Nebadon right next to Andromeda, and it's a lot bigger, and it's tidally distorting. It's messing up Andromeda.
You know, could have gotten some Nebadon from it.
Just like, you know, just like, what was that?
Could have gotten some of Nebadon from it.
No, I mean, I'm sure that, that nebula is all in Nebadon.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, it's one, it's part of the rest of, remember we talked about Andromeda is, you know, at best, say a ninth,
yeah, right.
You know, maybe only a 20th. Yeah. Right, there's a lot of other stuff. So, yeah. See, so there, just a reminder that even though here where we're reading, it all sounds kind of you're just out in the middle of nowhere and it's all this beautiful spiral. And, you know, no, you're down in the midst of all this other stuff and it's getting messed up a bit. Okay? And
they don't do anything at this stage to...
Right.
Maybe they do.
It's not like Nebadon needs to be a spiral thing. Right? It's just going to be, you know, stars strewn all over some region of space. It doesn't have to have any, you know, internal structure.
Seems like the master physical controllers would know to some degree, have insight and foresight.
Sure, right. They you can calculate.
We see this island, dark island coming.
Of course, it's not. They're not surprised by that. I mean, they calculate all this in advance. All that is taken into account long before. You know, all this stuff. I mean, they know all the physics of taking millions and millions of objects and getting them all together and all the gravitational interactions. And they calculate all that to the 90th decimal place. Yeah. Everything is all precisely controlled. And
probably it takes billions and billions of years.
Yeah. All right, so it's this huge project with all this complexity. See, and I've read that just to remind you, this sounds complicated enough just reading about Andromeda. No, it's a much bigger problem than that. Yeah, Andromeda is just a small part of the complexity of this problem. It's just a million objects, okay, sort of, right? This is, you know, it's a really big problem, requiring lots of logistics and father-like intervention, right? There is father-like intervention into this. They're tweaking things and whatnot, you know, at the same time. All right, so back to paper 57. So now let's get to that point, you know, that they were just alluding to, that, you know, roughly 300 billion years ago, where on the one hand you started building all of those architectural worlds, what else was going on? Let's see what they say here.
300 billion years ago, the Andromeda solar circuits were well established, and the nebular system was passing through a transient period of relative physical stability. About this time, the staff of Michael arrived on Salvington, and the Uversa government of Orvontan extended physical recognition to the local universe of Nebadon.
Okay, so see that that's starting to give you a sense of like what I was saying. It feels like, and the more you read this, the more you get this sense that there isn't a huge disparity. In the state of the evolution of all these nebulae that make up Nebadon. They seem like they're all kind of roughly probably in the same right. state of evolution, right? Like I said, I mean, if you're building all 100 constellations, that seems to suggest that, right? You're not just building 10 and eventually, you know, you'll get another 10. And so,
when they found the space 987 billion years ago, the whole space where it's going to be, then they... all sort of come together, and they're kind of explaining one of them right here. Right?
Yeah. See, so they're just focusing on this as an example of the greater whole. See, you know, it gives you all the basics by just focusing on what's most fun to focus on, where our sun came from, right? But it's giving you a sense of what's happening in the greater Nebadon region. It's just more of this basic thing. And, you know, just like, you know, what we talk about in our local system, they appear to make worlds about 200 at a time. You know, I mean, we move them forward, terraform them and move them to inhabited worlds about 200 at a time. So you got 200 worlds that are all kind of in about the same stage of evolution. Right, so they can tell us about the neighboring planet, and it's like, wow, that's not that different from us. That's because it was, you know, initiated basically when ours was, and we're all just kind of moving along in parallel. Right, so you have that happening here in this big picture, and things are, you know, at 300 billion years ago, Andronover is it's far from finished. We got a lot of big stuff to happen yet, but the basic coils of the spiral are solidly established. The Andronover solar circuits were well established. You've got gazillions of stars, you know, to make yet and stuff, you know. But the basic morphology is established firmly, okay. And also apparently the rest of the stuff in Nebadon is roughly, you know, it's roughed out. You just need to flesh in the details. Now, I want to give you another little thing. About this time, the staff of Michael arrived. Now, you know, we don't know...
Did he create most of his staff?
No. That's what I'm going to get at. That's what I'm saying. So we're going to read this. You know, the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit undoubtedly can travel quite rapidly. You know, so even though they don't say that, one would assume that the two of them are out in location relatively quickly, compared to the Tertiafim, that they're referring to here, that also have to, you know, be transported out there at three times the speed of light, right? That's going to be, you know. But when you're dealing with steps that are 100 billion years in size here, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of years it took them to travel out is irrelevant, right, to the story here. Right, at about 300 billion years ago, the Tertiafim head out there. So I just wanted to go back and read you that, too. That's on page 306 in the single column. It's paper 28, section 1. I want to read the second and third paragraphs of section 1 there on the Tertiafim. Because, again, it'll remind you of what we're, you know, what's between the lines of what they're telling us here in paper 57. It says, when a Michael son is detached from the parental regime of paradise and is made ready to go forth on the universe adventure of space, the infinite spirit is delivered, again, the female, you know, terminology there, right, the mother terminology, it's an infinite mother spirit, remember, is delivered of a group of 1,000 of these companion spirits. And these majestic Tertiafim accompany the Creator Son, you know, and Creator Spirit, when he embarks upon the adventure of universe organization.
That's his staff.
That's his staff. The next sentence. Throughout the early times of universe building, these 1,000 Tertiafim are the only personal staff of a Creator Son. So it's just Creator Son, Creator Spirit. Remember, it's not a creative mother spirit yet, just a creative spirit, and these 1,000 Tertiafim. That's all there is. The Tertiafim, they acquire a mighty experience as sun assistants during these stirring ages of universe assembling and other astronomical manipulations. See, we're going to be reading some of those details, just, you know, you see when they arrive and how unfinished Nebadon is yet through the example of the Andronover Nebula. I mean, these Tertiafim are involved in a lot of very grand stuff, you know, universe assembling, right? They got a lot of parts, but they're not where they need to end up being and whatnot. Lots of assembly required when they when a Creator Son and Creator Spirit and the tertiary of Him go out to this just roughed out by the power beings local universe. Okay. And it's purposely just left in a roughed out fashion because the details are in the hands of the Creator Son and Creator Spirit. And remember, it's the Creator Spirit that is going to function initially like a power being and do a lot of the really big picture power being stuff out there. You know, sort of the bulk patterning of the thing. Again, it's more of the holistic manipulation. See, the astronomical. She can manipulate things holistically, whereas all the power beings are micromanaging stuff, you know. They're moving this marble over there, right? But she has this presence as a creative spirit, you know, that is just going to, in her presence, things are going to get coordinated, right? Okay. They obviously leave the details to your imagination. But anyway, continuing on there. So what about the other? These Tershifim, they serve by the side of the Creator Son until the day of the personalization of the bright and morning star, the firstborn of a local universe. Thereupon, the formal resignations of the Tershifim are tendered and accepted. And with the appearance of the initial orders of native angelic life, you know, getting all of the other stuff created besides Gabriel in our case, they, the Tershifim, retire from active service in the local universe and become the liaison ministers between the Creator Son of former attachment and the Ancients of Days of the super universe concerned. So they're the go-betweens. Okay. So keep that in mind, that at 300 billion years ago, all we have is the Tershifim. But, you know, in the not-too-distant future from that point, you're going to get all the local universe beings starting to be created by a Creator Son and at that point, a creative Mother Spirit. So at some point between 300 billion and 200 billion, as we're about to read, right, you have the primary eruption, right? And the creative Spirit becomes a creative Mother Spirit, and she ceases to do the power being stuff and starts to be the other parent to all these local universe children that they're going to generate. You know, and she's going to generate her own, you know, all of the, you know, her angels and et cetera. Okay. So let's go back to paper 57 and look at the 200 billion years ago here.
200 billion years ago witnessed the progression of contraction and condensation, which with enormous heat generation in the Andromeda central cluster or nuclear mass. Relative space appeared even in the regions near the central mother-sun wheel. The outer regions were becoming more stabilized and better organized. Some planets revolving around the newborn suns had cooled sufficiently to be suitable for life implantation. The oldest inhabited planets of Nebadon date from these times.
Okay, so we still have all of this contraction and condensation. Right? I mean, you still have basically, you have this central nucleus, but you can still, up to this point, you should be visualizing something that's pretty continuously a gas cloud out into the disk still. But things are continuing to contract, and eventually you start to get breaks. I mean, you know, there starts to be break in that, you know, cloud, that disk cloud. And see, relative space appeared even in the regions near the central. So you're starting to get some of that gas really all into the center. The cloud of the disk is starting to break up, right? You're getting holes, gaps, you know, in the smooth gas. Okay, so you know it's getting close to the point where basically all the gas is in the center, and it's not much residual out in the outer disk left, okay, except what's being put out there through the, you know, the bipolar ejection, you know, through the spiral, you know, into the spiral. And see, notice here that at this point, you know, out of the outer regions of that initial whirl, you know, diameter. The outer regions are becoming more stabilized and better organized. You know, things are really settling down out there. You know, you don't have stuff blasted out and disrupting. It's starting to get a bit settled. And apparently in Nebadon in general, there's a number of regions now that, even though a lot of really chaotic stuff is still going to happen in some places, you know, the hinterlands are not going to be disrupted in any significant way from this point on. And so they can actually think about terraforming worlds and implanting life in some of these places. You get the impression that not just Nebadon in general, but apparently, you know, even in some of those stars that were way out from the center in Andromeda, maybe got inhabited here about 200 billion years ago. Well, if you've got inhabited life, you've got all of the local universe beings in play.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you've got to have Lananadex, you know, a local, you know, local system headquarters, and you've got to have Seraphim and right, the whole nine yards. Material sons and daughters. And right. See, so between 300 billion and 200 billion, the Tertiafim have left, and all the local universe beings have, you know, been, at least the ones that you need at this point, you know, have all been brought into existence. Okay, you know, the ones that are just, you know, all made at the beginning, right, are all made now, right, by the time you get to 200 billion years ago. See, so that's how old, you know, like Melchizedek's and whatnot, you know, are. They date back somewhere between 200 and 300 billion years ago.
So when they talk later on about, I think it was a mighty messenger that wrote, was part of this, was from Nebadon, is that correct? Somebody they refer to that as a being who must have come from a...
Right, you, yeah, right, you can imagine, you know, it's going to be one of these very early planets.
Yeah, that it takes somewhere between, you know, maybe 150 and 200 million, billion years to get... For that particular being.
You know, and you get the impression that might be kind of a beeline.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Other beings take a lot longer, but other ascenders.
Right, and then but you wonder if you have to go through a billion perfect worlds.
Right.
Time is probably different because, you know, they say, what do they say, 1,000, one day is like 1,000 years or something like that, or I mean.
Well, but again, you know, one of the things to remember, you know.
You know, I'm driving.
I know what you're driving at, but, you know. But just, you know, don't think of it so much more in the subjective relativity of time thing.
Okay.
But just, you know, everyone is going to, like, especially when you're going through Avona, remember, that's not a group. You're going through as an individual.
Right.
Right, so, you know, no one in your group is holding you back or anything like that. If the type of personality you have means that you can go through Havona quite, you know, relatively rapidly, you know, you'll get there, get to paradise a lot quicker than others. See, and it's interesting, you're noticing that there's this mighty messenger that seems like it probably went kind of quickly. Well, what happened to that? As soon as he was inducted into the core of the finality, the Trinity snatched him out and short-circuited the rest of his whole process. See, and they go, oh, I wonder if that's not a coincidence. You know, maybe if you're going to do an awful lot of stuff as a finaliter, it takes you a long time to accumulate the potential for that in Havona. But if you're really going to have it given to you by fiat, a lot of that completion is just going to be given to you by fiat by the Paradise Trinity, maybe that means you go through Havona a lot faster. Because you don't really need to build up all that potential. It's just going to be dumped on you. You know, by fiat, the actualization. See, so you could rationalize, you could speculate.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things to me is, which is a very good lesson for me personally, is don't be in a hurry.
Right. Especially if in eternity, you know, relative to eternity, you know, your eternal destiny, you're a being that definitely should never be in a hurry because you're the one that's supposed to be going the slowest. You know, and someone else that has a very different destiny than you is the one that's supposed to be going the fastest. Right? We all need to just humbly find our place. You know, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I mean, there is no too slow or too fast. Or it all depends upon how you fit into the whole. You know, if some beings you can't make properly if if they go too slow. Some beings you can't make properly if they go too fast.
It's just comfort.
It's all different, right? And just so you just just let go of all the tension of time. Just let it be what it is. All right. But again, the other little thing is planets that started 200 billion years ago. How deeply into light life are they, right?
This was 14
billion years ago. They are really deep into light life, right?
So let's say that means there's probably some systems that are into light life already in our universe, right?
Yeah, systems and constellations, in some of the other local universes, like we talked about.
So back to this one, you're talking about, they basically describe how our universe, our solar system and our place in the sky was created, try to get a picture from it. And then once you get into, and obviously maybe somebody out of the Andromeda is already in light and life already, a whole system could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if that's the case, do their physical properties, like their sun, do they get to a point of where they don't, burn out, so to speak, do you think? Or do you think they get taken over?
Now, remember how that works is the stars get encircuited. The power beings kind of plug them in, and so they never wind down. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, but stars that don't become a sun for an inhabited planet or planets, they can be let to just burn down to a cinder and. Become
but
a dark
the
island.
You have around the sun might change, right? Or does that
not? No, I mean, remember, it's just cooling off and becoming a cinder. Its mass doesn't change. I mean, everything just continues to orbit it as always.
It's still out there.
Same. Yeah, I mean, it's still there. It's just, okay. It's just no longer hot
Jupiter
and glowing.
Jupiter's no longer gaseous.
Right.
Interesting, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, Jupiter will continue to collapse because, it's still pretty hot inside. It'll continue to cool and collapse over time. But again, is Jupiter a part of the grand universe settled in light and life, like we've talked about? Who knows? Maybe it gets swept up at some point. I don't know what becomes of all this, material. But anyway, all right. So just read that one quick little thing, and I'll make a comment there.
Now the completed universe mechanism of Nibidon first begins to function, and Michael's creation is registered on Uversa as a universe of inhabitation and progressive mortal ascension.
Right. See, so again, notice how that speaks to, it appears that the fact that Andronovir has gotten to the point where it has some relatively settled parts, all of Nebadon seems to have gotten, to a point where it has some relatively settled parts. You have the basic mechanism, as they're saying there, laid out. Right? There's still lots of detail to go, but the basic mechanism is there. So no matter how many nebulae were assembled to make Nebadon, there's not going to be huge shiftings and disruptions of all that matter. It apparently is all kind of roughly where it's going to be. And even if you have the Andronovir central nucleus still has on a lot of material that needs to get spread out into that immediate region, it's not material that needs to be clear over there or whatnot. Right? The basic framework, if you will, of Nebadon is in place. Okay. All right. So what about the next one here?
100 billion years ago. The nebular apex of condensation tension was reached. The point of maximum heat tension was attained. This critical stage of gravity heat contention sometimes lasts for ages, but sooner or later, heat wins the struggle with gravity, and the spectacular period of sun dispersion begins. And this marks the end of the secondary career of a space nebula.
See what they're getting to here, where it really has gotten to the point where you really don't have a disk of gas per se anymore. Really, all the gas has gotten collected in the center, and it's getting very hot. and you have this contention, right? On the one hand, you have gravity wanting to contract it, and the other hand, you have heat wanting to expand it, right? And eventually, it's going to get so hot that you know, the pressure cooker, you know, has got to be relieved, right? And so, significant amount of material is going to head out into the spiral arms.
Not a supernova,
right? It's going to head out. You know, there's two release valves on that pressure cooker, right? The exit points, you know, for the spiral arms, you know, out of the central nucleus. So it's, you know, we've had some stars coming out, but now a lot of stars, okay, are going to start, or material to make stars is going to start heading out of the central nucleus.
Kind of like 4th of July.
Yeah, yep. So the pinwheel is really going to get going here now. Okay. All right. So let's go to the next section here.
Number 4: tertiary and quartan stages. The primary stage of a nebula is circular, the secondary spiral. The tertiary stage is that of the first sun dispersion, while the quartan embraces the second and last cycle of sun dispersion, with the mother nucleus ending either as a globular cluster or as a solitary sun functioning as the center of a terminal solar system.
Which, of course, is what happened with the Andromeda Nebula, as I'll say at the end of the section. Just note the one little thing, you know, this first sun dispersion, you know, there's kind of quotes around that. There are some suns already out, but this is the first of this really major exodus, right? There was sort of the, you know, the beginning tail of it is what's been going on in the secondary. And you'll see here shortly, you know, in terms of that batch of suns, they take the ones that are, you know, literally coming out in the tertiary and combining them with the ones that came out, you know, this relatively smaller number that came out before during the secondary stage. Okay.
75 billion years ago, this nebula had attained the height of its sun family stage. This was the apex of the first period of sun losses. The majority of these suns have since possessed themselves of extensive systems of planets, satellites, dark islands, comets, meteors, and cosmic dust clouds.
I mean, all that's pretty straightforward. Just remember, there's stellar-sized dark islands.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So you can have a binary system of a glowing star, you know, and a cinder. A black dwarf, you know, is what us current scientists would call it. You know, just a burnt-out cinder.
Very dense, right?
That's right, it's very, very dense, yes.
So a lot of...
Again, it's just whatever gravity it had and whatever mass it had. You know, but it doesn't get, you know, gravity doesn't increase when, you know, just because it, you know, condenses. Because mass doesn't increase, it's just, you know, the density increases. Notice the one little thing here. You know, we were jumping 100 billion years at a time. Now we just jumped 25 billion. So we've got, you know, these things, you know, it's reminding you, it starts out kind of linear. And then it starts to exponentiate. And you'll see that, you know, continuing here. As we get to the finishing of this project, you know, it starts to really, you know, in relative terms, it's like whoosh, and it's done. You know, you're plodding along. It's like, well, a little bit changed over that 100 billion years. You know, now it's going to be, you know, in 100 billion years, it's all done. This is, you know, one of the things that makes you suspicious that maybe all of the finite evolution of the outer space levels, you know, might have a similar geometric or exponential thing at the end, where everything is kind of putzing along, you know, arithmetically right now, and it looks like it'll take forever to finish the second outer space level, for instance, let alone what about the third and the fourth, right? You know, and it may be the case as you get closer and closer to the grand universe being settled in light and life, that physical stuff in the outer space levels, that finite physical stuff, you know, might just go... right, in relative terms, trillions and trillions of years have gone by, you know, and it relatively short amount of time, things will radically change out there.
Well, they kind of, sets up the supreme being actualized.
Just in time for us to get there.
Anyway, so just, you know, it's just, obviously I'm just speculating, but, you know, you're always kind of suspicious when you see one pattern, if you can apply that at smaller or larger scales. Okay. Okay, but see, the basic thing, you're going to have 50 billion years here, where this sun dispersion, it's ramping up for 25 billion and then ramping down into completion in another 25 billion. Okay, so this little up and down. And at 75, you're at the peak, and then you're going to tail off here to the next one. See, so go to the next block there. Yes. Oh, is there a question?
Yeah. Wondering if you know the etymology of the word quartan.
Just four. Just means four, right? We have primary, one, secondary, two, tertiary, three, and quartan, four. First stage, second stage, third stage, fourth stage. Okay.
50 billion years ago, this first period of sun dispersion was completed. The nebula was fast finishing its tertiary cycle of existence, during which it gave origin to 876,926 sun systems.
Okay, so like I just said a moment ago, see, that number is, you know, includes all the ones that were done, you know, out there before the tertiary officially started at 100 billion. And, well, how do you know that? Well, because when you get to the end of the section, that becomes apparent, okay? That they've just lumped those together. And they do that, just like I said, because it's just relatively a few that came out before 100 billion years ago. Right? I mean, you know, some of them go back 500 billion years. That's when you had the first one, right? So that's pretty straightforward to straighten out. The thing that's really bizarre is that specific number. 876926. You've seen that number before, and in a completely non-secular way. Flip back to the next to the last paragraph of section one. You know, go back to 875 billion years ago. 875 billion years ago, the enormous Andromeda Nebula number 876926 was duly initiated. Huh?
Yeah.
No idea. How you resolve that. I mean, obviously, it's not like nebula number one only had one star in the tertiary stage, and nebula two, no, you see, that doesn't make any sense. What in the world, why are those two numbers exactly the same?
Not a typo.
I mean, you when you finish the section, you know that in section four, That number is proper. It matches up with the numbers at the end of the section.
Which says a little further on, there's a million of them, right?
Yeah. That's what I said. When we get there, we'll see that this number fits in with the numbers at the end of the section. Okay. So if you wanted to suspect that there was a blooper, you would have to assume that it's not Nebula 876926. But why that would be a blooper, I have no idea. You're just left with an unresolvable mystery, in my opinion, about why so those two numbers. You know, it's obviously it's got to be roughly nebula number 800,000, because, you know, we saw that with inspector number 811,307. You know, you're in that ballpark on the number of little galaxies that you've made.
So, sun system.
Okay.
Would that be like a solar system? Could there be two suns in a system?
We'll get to that in a little bit. I'll explain that when we get to the end of the section. But right now, just, you know, set that aside. But just the point is that you've got a very bizarre coincidence of numbers there. I have no idea how to approach that.
What do they call it? Your golden birthday? So So this just happens to be the nebula where this happened, you know, the first sun dispersion cycle is kind of special. So this is the one where, the first one where they coincided and they're like, oh.
Yeah, we love to think that we live in the most special place in the universe of universes. So you could add this to your rationalization scheme that out of all of the, in all the local universes in the entire grand universe, this
God loved the most.
Like I said, I have no idea what to do with that fact.
Jesus loved the most.
It's a very strange little bit of trivia in the book. Anyway, so you've got this big batch has been spewing out into the mix. Let's go to the next block here.
25 billion years ago witnessed the completion of the tertiary cycle of nebular life and brought about the organization and relative stabilization of the far-flung starry systems derived from this parent nebula. But the process of physical contraction and increased heat production continued in the central mass of the nebular remnant.
Okay, so you kind of spewed them all out there, and then 25 billion years after you were done spewing them out there, things had pretty much, you know, settled down into place. But you still have a lot of matter, much more than a star-sized amount of matter in the center, and things are still contracting. So another little pressure cooker thing is building here with the residual. But you certainly bled off a lot of it, you know, in this big event. And that just means it's going to have to condense all the more to build up to some sort of a release point, okay? But definitely by 25 billion years ago, you can see, if you were to look at Nebadon, if everything is kind of in the same mode as Andromeda, you know, it would start to, you know, to look in a much more close to finished state, right? But nothing is, even now, is very finished. You know, they tell you it's a wild and woolly energy domain here in Norlaishadeck. Our constellation has got a lot of activity that they weren't actively shielding us from. And we're going to see about this issue of how disruptive things are still, you know, back at this point. But they're still relatively disruptive right now. You couldn't have life on this planet if they weren't shielding us from the high energies that are still just, you know, out and about, right, in this neck of the woods, okay? But the fun thing to think about is, you know, we've got things really far down the road and being quite settled, and we're still 25 billion years ago, you know, and our foolish ideas of how old the universe is of 13.8 billion, we're still basically twice that distance in time, okay? So just kind of notice that.
A little short-sighted.
Yeah, we're obviously very, very ignorantly extrapolating our current information to that conclusion of 13.8 billion. You know, that's just a completely trivial number. You know, we think of it as the number. You know, it doesn't get any bigger than that. That's the biggest number there is. No, it's just peanuts in the scale of the evolution of things. Okay.
10 billion years ago, the Corton cycle of Andromeda began. The maximum of nuclear mass temperature had been attained. The critical point of condensation was approaching. The original mother nucleus was convulsing under the combined pressure of its own internal heat condensation tension and the increasing gravity tidal pull of the surrounding swarm of liberated sun systems. The nuclear eruptions, which were to inaugurate the second nebular sun cycle, were imminent. The Corton cycle of nebular existence was about to begin.
So that the two things they're talking about in terms of unsettledness, the combined, you know, you have the pressure of its own internal heat condensation tension. Again, like, you know, picture those images of the sun that you've seen close up, you know, where there's matter just boiling out of it, you know, and this big frothy, you know, chaos. Right, I mean, you got that happening on this massive scale, this very hot object. Just, you know, plus you've got all these stars tugging on it, tidal, you know, like the moon tugs on the Earth and the sun tugs on the. I mean, all those stars are tugging on this blob of gas, you know, and it's so it's, you know, it's fluctuating and it's going to start to, you know, come apart. Okay. Yeah, but when they say that the maximum of nuclear mass temperature had been attained, it hasn't gone to the point where it's like one big sun, even though I was just using that analogy of the frothy surface, right? You know, it hasn't got to the point where collections of 100 ultimatons down in the center of this are unraveling or anything. This is not like one great big sun that's going to fly apart. Okay, this is still a nebula. This is still a ball of gas. That hasn't gone into one giant star. Okay.
8 billion years ago, the terrific terminal eruption began. Only the outer systems are safe at the time of such a cosmic upheaval. And this was the beginning of the end of the nebula. This final sun disgorgement extended over a period of almost 2 billion years.
So here, instead of 25 billion up and to the peak and then 25 billion down to the end of it. Here it's just a billion up and a billion down. It's a lot, you know, faster. Yeah, it's a smaller number of stars, but, you know, not extremely smaller. So this is all happening in a much faster scale.
So only the outer systems are safe.
Yeah, right, so that, and I was just, right, I mean, yeah, right. So I was just going to get to that. So see, here's where you understand that you've got this vast Andromeda Nebula system, but you're just about to have this huge disruption happening in the center, and it would kill any life. You know, then the master physical controllers couldn't stop it from doing that, of anything that had been inhabited close in. So again, the only thing that could possibly be inhabited, even at this late, you know, is way out stuff that was protected.
It came off a long time
ago. See, so again, have they built any local system headquarters in this inner region of the Andromeda Nebula? No, because they would have been vaporized, right? Right. See, so no wonder they couldn't start building some of them until 5 billion years ago.
Marantia and material, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, you can't have architectural spheres, obviously, anywhere in this region. So you're going, well, I mean, the Consolos Constellation headquarters must be out of range. So it gives you some clues about, you know, where they're building stuff and where they aren't. And that definitely until you get to 6 billion years ago, there's going to be places there's no way you could build a local system headquarters, you know, set of worlds there yet. All right, keep going here.
7 billion years ago witnessed the height of the Andromeda terminal breakup. This was the period of the birth of the larger terminal suns and the apex of the local physical disturbances.
Okay, so you get some pretty big suns coming out. And going to continue to the next one. So we've reached the peak. Now tails down to the end.
6 billion years ago marks the end of the terminal breakup and the birth of your sun, the 56th from the last of the Andromeda second solar family. This final eruption of the nebular nucleus gave birth to 136,702 suns, most of them solitary orbs. The total number of suns and sun systems having origin in the Andromeda Nebula was 1,013,628. The number of the solar system sun is 1,013,572.
Just in case you can't do the math. Okay, so this here's what I want to talk about the sun systems. See,
yeah.
You see now, you know, but so when you get down to this last, 136,000. You're putting out stuff that tends to condense into a star that's not so big that it flies apart and makes a binary star system. Remember, if you've got too much stuff that initially is, you know, collecting together into a star, it's going to blob apart, you know, into two, you know, and they're going to go into orbit about each other. So a lot of those binaries, see, happened out of those initial 876 and whatnot. It was a big enough blob that it split into a binary star system. But most of the time, see, they count that as just one star. You know, that binary star is really one, because initially it was one thing and then it split apart into two. You know, just like we almost ended up with a binary star. I mean, Jupiter is pretty darn close. If it was a little bit bigger, you know, it could have been a very small star. We almost got split up into two stars, you know, by that dark island going past. Yeah. But a lot of times it's just too much matter and it spins faster and faster and boom, you know, it flies apart into two stars. But that's just counted as one in these numbers that they're giving you all the time, right? And these numbers, you know, all match with this 876, 926, like I said. See, you know, I mean, so that number is in agreement with all these.
Could be a coincidence.
I just, you know, what to make
that's
of that?
Bizarre.
What that back in section one? I don't know. It's very strange.
Good example.
But anyway, just, you know, talk about. Well, I wanted to be first. Well, you're 56th from the last. Okay, we are really at the tail end of this whole process. And like we've said, this is only roughly a million stars.
We barely made it,
right? You need a lot more than a million stars to make a local universe.
Yeah, right. 10
million. Right. I mean, you've got 10 million inhabited worlds. That, you know, so you need significantly more stars. You know, and the answer is not, you know, binary stars. Or, you know. Again, see, so it's just Andromeda is a very small part of Nebadon. No matter how you slice it. Okay, just one last little comment here.
And now the Great Andromeda Nebula is no more, but it lives on in the many suns and their planetary families, which originated in this mother cloud of space. The final nuclear remnant of this magnificent nebula still burns with a reddish glow and continues to give forth moderate light and heat to its remnant planetary family of 165 worlds, which now revolve about this venerable mother of two mighty generations of the monarchs of light.
God, that helped push the average up.
Little poetic flourish there.
100 and some worlds.
All right, so, and how many of those are inhabited? Who knows? But, you know, maybe none, you know, for all we know. Maybe it's just too harsh there. I mean, maybe none of those are inhabited. But there is one star that is highly suspicious that is this remnant. You know, so you finally, you know, you've got a nebula, just a nebula. Like I said, you know, it isn't a super giant star. Right? It's just a nebula. But eventually, you're down to something that's star-sized left in the center. Okay? You know it's going to be a really, really big star. There is a red supergiant star that is not that far away. That, you know, seems like it'd be kind of roughly, you know, fitting with what they're talking about here, and that's Antares.
Which means not Mars.
right. You know, it's because it's red, you know, like Mars, and so they matched it up with Mars. But Antares is in Scorpius. You know, the Scorpion constellation, you know, that whole bit of it looking like a big J in the sky, that Scorpion shape. But see, again, it's not like you're looking towards Salvington when you're looking towards Antares, right? See, so that's overplaying it, the whole J for Jesus thing, and you're looking towards, you know, I mean, it's,
cool.
But, you know, it is a red supergiant. You know, the orbit of Mars fits comfortably inside of that star.
Wow.
That's a big star.
That's a big star.
Right? Okay.
That has has that many planets around.
And it's got, see, obviously that makes sense. You know, you're down to that last bit of debris. Okay, you got most of it in a star, but there's going to be tons of remaining debris. All that stuff, gas was in the disk, you know, that was coming in. You know, a lot of that's going to end up making these planets, right? You know, the way they think our solar system formed, you know, where you had a bunch of gas and most of it collected into the star in the center and the rest made the planets, right? This is most likely happened just that way, right? The rest of the stuff that didn't actually end up in that central star made all these planets. And if it is Antares, that's a binary star. And that would make sense too. No, it is a binary star. I mean, it makes sense too, because you know you have this last blob, you know, it's likely going to be too big, right? And it's going to split apart into two.
Right.
See, so it's very suspicious, you know. Of all the stars, it's the one that just really jumps out at you is likely this.
Give you a hint with the
Wrench glow. Is Antares, right? So can't prove it, but highly suspicious that's Antares. All right. So finally we've gotten down to something that we think is a more manageable chunk of time, 5 billion years ago. That's what we'll pick up here. But just think about how delightful this is, you know, that the story doesn't start here at section 5. That all this stuff, you know, that there's no way that we can even remotely imagine. Going back almost a trillion years ago, happened before we think everything got started with us.
Yeah, it's one of the newest there is.
Yeah. All right. So So we'll kind of get a little closer to home now. You know, as we go into the next section, and we'll start to talk about how what they say is more in line with what humans think about the origin of the planet. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.